We are continuing to, we spent several hours this week working on the PA system, but we still continue to have issues. We apologize for that, but we'll get through it the best way that we possibly can, and I hope that that you can hear me. I hope it's not one of those situations where that preacher was up preaching one time, and there was a guy sitting at the back, said, "We can't hear you," so he talked a little bit louder. And the guy at the back stood up and said, "We can't hear you," so he talked a little louder. And the guy at the back stood up third time, "We can't hear you," and the guy sitting in the front said, "What's the matter, can't you hear him?" "Yeah, oh, I can't hear him." "Well, I can, swap places with me." We're glad you're here. You may or may not be aware of this, but my mother taught kindergarten for many years, along with teaching piano lessons. And our daughter-in-law, Abby, also teaches kindergarten. And it is interesting and at the same time amusing and even enlightening sometimes to hear the stories of the events of their day. You know, it's with kindergarten-age kids, it's kind of like the old story that, you know, every family has secrets until the teacher in the preschool Sunday school class asks for prayer requests. But it's interesting and amusing to hear the stories of kindergarten teachers. Well, I wanted us to talk this morning on the thought of the idea of what is God like. And thinking about what God is like, it reminded me of a story that came out of the kindergarten classroom. It seems that there was a kindergarten teacher who was observing the students in her classroom while they were doing artwork and they were drawing pictures. And she would walk around the classroom and inspect each child's artwork. And she got to this one little girl who is got her head down and just diligently working on her drawing. And the teacher says, "What are you drawing there?" And the little girl said, "I'm drawing God." And the teacher paused and looked at her and she said, "But sweetie, no one knows what God looks like." Little girl just kept drawing, didn't miss a beat. Never looked up and said, "When I'm finished with my drawing, they will." Well, you know, you think about that. And what I'm proposing to do is to try to tell you what God is like. And to try to tell people, to tell others what God is like, that's a daunting job. Because you see, in my feeble way, I cannot even come close really to doing justice to tell you what God is like. Because our finite human minds are incapable of actually fully comprehending God. Because our religion, Christianity, my friends, it is a religion of faith. As Paul would write to the church at Corinth in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, Paul said, "We walk by faith and not by sight." God is the creator and God is the supreme governor of this universe. And God is the very center of our faith. And we cannot reduce God to the molds of human understanding. To think of God is to, by faith, ascend to the mountain's heights. It is to reach a summit that cannot really be reached by finite minds such as mine and yours. To think of God is to explore a depth that to human mentality is actually an unfathomable depth. And so we are led with Paul to exclaim in the words of our text. We find it in Romans chapter 11 and verse 33. "Oh, the depths of the riches both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out. If God could be completely fathomed by man, He would not be God, and at the same time all that the name God suggests. However, we can acquire a somewhat satisfying and practical working knowledge of God and His will. Being finite, while God is infinite, we can't paint an exact likeness of God upon the canvas. We cannot reduce God to a mathematical demonstration. The best that we can do is to look at the likeness of God. And yet that even begs the question, what is God like? That's something that mankind has always wondered about. That's something that has always puzzled us. And since none of us have seen God, we have to get our description of God from someone who has seen Him. When we turn to this book, when we read the Bible, we see that God has given us a perfect picture of Himself. He did that when He sent His Son, Jesus Christ. So much so that Jesus would declare in John 14 and verse 9, "He that hath seen Me hath seen the Father." You remember in John chapter 4, when Jesus had a conversation with that Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, He explained to her that God is a spirit, and they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. That's in John chapter 4 and verse 24. You see, God is not the material creation of the hands of man. And being a spirit, God cannot be confined to temples. And God is, being spirit, omnipresent. Being spirit, God is not a tribal deity. He's not merely a God for the Jews or a God for the Samaritans. He's the God of everyone. The story is told that one day a man who was a skeptic, or what you might call a free thinker, met a very simple man, much like myself, on his way to church. And the skeptic inquired of the man, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to church." He said, "Well, why are you going to church?" The man replied, "I'm going to church to worship God." And the skeptic asked him, he said, "Is the God you worship a great God, or is He a little God?" And he asked it somewhat whimsically, almost sarcastically, almost in derision. And the man replied, "Sir, my God is so great, the heaven of heavens cannot contain Him. And He's so small, He can dwell inside my heart." The skeptic said, that simple answer had more effect upon his mind than all the volumes that learned and scholarly men had ever written. What is God like? God sees us, me and you. And God not only sees me and you, God knows me and God knows you. God sees us. God knows our hearts. I read a story that came out of a period of time when life was hard, when people had very little. And it seems a father very foolishly took his young son with him into a farmer's cornfield because he was going to steal some corn. They took a sack and they made their way in the dark to the farmer's cornfield. But before he started picking the corn and putting it in the sack, the father looked all around. And he looked to make sure no one was watching and that there weren't any eyes seeing what it was that he was about to do. And he said to the boy, he said, "Son, hold the sack open so I can put the corn in it." And he started picking corn and putting it in the sack. And the little boy said, "Daddy, there was one direction you didn't look." The man was frightened. He was afraid the boy had seen someone. And the father said, "Where did I not look, son?" The young lad said, "Daddy, you didn't look up." The father dropped the sack, took his son by the hand, and they went home without the stolen corn. If we remember, always remember, God sees us. God knows everything. We will not fail to consider the eyes from above that are watching every move that we make. We read of Adam in the long ago when he was in the garden and he and Eve had eaten the forbidden fruit. And Adam tried to hide from God and God said, "Adam, where art thou?" And Adam said, "Well, Lord, I was naked and I was hiding because I was ashamed." "How did you know you were naked, Adam? Did you eat the fruit that I told you not to eat?" You know, we read about Adam in the garden and we read about Adam trying to hide from God and we almost chuckle when we think about his foolishness trying to hide from God. And yet Adam trying to hide from God, that is no more foolish than many of our own vain efforts to conceal the thoughts, the purposes, and the motives of our hearts from God. In that upper room, that night that Jesus ate the Passover with the disciples, we get a glimpse of God there. Listen to the words of Jesus in John 15, verses 1 and 2. "I am the true vine," he said, "and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purges it that it may bring forth more fruit." In that passage, we see Jesus as the vine. And we see ourselves as individual Christians as the branches in the vine. God is the husbandman or the vine dresser. What's the job of the husbandman in the vine, in the vineyard? The husbandman trims the unfruitful branches. He cuts off the unfruitful branches. And you see, as Christians, when we lose contact with Jesus Christ, we don't bear fruit. It's from the vine, Jesus, that the branches, Christians, draw the sustenance that's necessary to life and fruit production. Bearing fruit is a condition that's necessary to remaining in the vine. Bearing fruit is essential to being a follower of Jesus Christ. Here's what Jesus says in John 15 and verse 8. "Herein is my Father glorified, that you bear much fruit so that you are my disciples." Write this down. It's on the final exam. The disciple that does not bear fruit loses his or her discipleship. God sees us. God knows us. God is also a judge. The writer of the Hebrew letter declares in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 23, that God is the judge of all. In our day and time, there is a tendency to emphasize the grace of God, the love of God, the mercy of God. Sometimes I think there's too much of an emphasis on the grace of God and the love of God and the mercy of God. While all of those are qualities of God, God does have a sterner side also. And we need to look at the sterner qualities of God from time to time. Paul reminded the Corinthians of that in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. He said, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in the body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or evil. We see the gentleness of God in the mellow sunlight that gently floods our world. We see it in the gentle breezes that blow. We see it in the flowers that blossom in the springtime. But we also see the terror of the Lord in nature, don't we? We see it in the flash of lightning and the roar of the thunder, the drenching floods and the terrible earthquakes. Those suggest a sterner side to the character of God. When we appear before the judgment seat of God, we are told the secret things of our lives. The time in the cornfield is going to be revealed. And it is there that our idle words must be accounted for. The purposes, the motives, the things that have guided our lives must be laid bare before God. And in view of that, we should be careful of our every thought, our every word, our every action. But at the same time, we need to be thankful that our judgment, God's judgment of us, is going to be by Jesus Christ. Because knowing that it's going to be by Jesus tells us that our judgment is going to be justice, but it's going to be justice tempered with mercy. The sternness of God is going to be softened by love, compassion and pity for poor, fallen man. That's me and you. Is going to warm the heart of him who knoweth our frame and remembered that we are dust. That's the way the psalmist puts it. Psalm 103. Verse 14. But I think that where we see what God is really like is when we see God as our Father. And I like to think of that as the highest characterization of God. You see, it is to Jesus that we are most indebted for this view of God. There are a few passages in the Old Testament that teach us about God as a Father. But we can safely say that no one before the coming of Jesus Christ habitually referred to God as Father. I've not personally counted them. I've read it. If you want to check it, you're welcome to personally count it. But I'm told and I've read there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 161 instances in the New Testament where Jesus refers to God as Father. There are numerous direct statements and illustrations in the teachings of Jesus that picture God to us as a Father. And perhaps nowhere is that done more distinctly than in the story of the prodigal son that Luke records for us. It's a story that all Bible readers are familiar with. It's the story of a young boy that goes to his father and he says, "I want my part of the inheritance and I want it now." And he leaves home and he goes to the far country. And he spends his inheritance in riotous living, the scriptures tell us. And then it's also about his selfish older brother. That when the prodigal son comes to his senses and returns home, and the father has a great celebration, his elder brother is jealous, petulant, sulled up, angry, and says, "I'm not going in for the party." Sometimes I think we've mislabeled this story. We have preached numerous texts and we've taught it the story of the prodigal son. And we've talked about the young boy that goes and spends his substance in riotous living. He spends it in the bars and on the harlots and in the gambling dens and the places of vice. That's what riotous living means, you know. And the elder brother, one represents the sins of passion, the sins of immorality. One represents the sins of a bad attitude. Both sons, in my opinion, are equally reprobates, just in different ways. I think the story would more aptly be labeled the parable of the loving father. Because the father loves both of those sons. Well, I have learned from Jesus Christ that God is my father. I want him to talk to me. And he does talk to me as he speaks to me through his word, this book that we call the Bible. The concept of the God of heaven being my Father makes this book, the Bible, this is a love letter from my heavenly Father that's written to me. And since God is my Father, I want to talk to Him. And so I spend time in prayer telling God the innermost feelings and the innermost thoughts of my heart and the longings of my heart and what I want and what I desire and what I'm thankful for and how much He has blessed me. I often think about my earthly father. It's been 30 years since I was able to talk to J.R. Oh, I'd like to talk to him again. I'd like to just sit down and visit with him. I'd like to sit down in front of the fireplace one more time with a cup of coffee. I'd like to tell him about his grandsons, the men they've become. I'd like to tell him about his great-grandsons. But I can't. I can't talk to JR anymore. But I can talk to my Heavenly Father. And I'm glad that Jesus told us and said, when you pray, what do we say, Lord? When you pray, say, "Our Father. It makes prayer seem more personal. And it makes prayer seem more to me than a dry, formal petition addressed to some faraway being, when I can bow my head and I can say, "Oh, Father." Nothing else, nothing more, just, "Oh, my Father." And seeing God as my Father. I want to take to Him all the burdens of my heart. I want to pour out before Him the tragedies of my soul. I want to confide to God the innermost secrets of my mind. I want to thank Him over and over and over for the bountiful supply of life's blessings that I have. Seeing God as my Father, I can visualize His joy over my successes. I can visualize His sympathy when I have to confess to Him my failures. Because I know what it's like to be a father. I've listened to such pleas from my children. And flawed though I might be, I would not allow their petitions and their longings to go unheeded. And knowing that, I know that my Heavenly Father, who is perfect, will always deal with me in a way that's dictated by perfect wisdom, tempered with perfect love. I'm so glad that Jesus revealed God as a loving Heavenly Father. What is God like? That's the question we started with, wasn't it? The best answer is, He's a Father. He's a super Father. A perfect Father. A Father who combines all the good traits of fatherhood. A Father who possesses supreme love, and who's guided in the application of that love by supreme wisdom. You know, I never doubted the love of my earthly father. I never doubted J.R. loved me. He always wanted to lead me in the right way. But like me, he was flawed. And he was sometimes subject to mistakes of human judgment. But there was one incident that I'll always remember. We had words one night. I was about 13, 14. And it's not uncommon for a teenage boy and his father to have words. But we had words one night. And he was wrong. He was dead wrong. And we went to bed. About 2:30 in the morning, the lamp beside my bed came on. What? My father is on his knees beside my bed, shaking me. He says, "Son, wake up." What? I mean, it's 2:30 in the morning. I'm sound asleep. What, Daddy? What do you want? "Son, I hadn't been able to sleep. I was wrong. I'm sorry."
I looked at him. I said, "You woke me up for that?" "Yeah." "Well, go to bed and go to sleep so I can. I love you, Dad. Love you too, son." That's a father. That's a loving father. The God of heaven is my father. The God of heaven is my loving father. I never need doubt the love of my heavenly father. But unlike my own judgment and the judgment of my earthly father, I can rely on the judgment of my heavenly father to be perfect. I can follow my heavenly father with the fullest measure of confidence. I can follow his direction to the minutest detail. And here's the beauty. I can never drift beyond the love and care of my heavenly father as long as I respect him and as long as I obey him as my father. Now here's the question. Is God your father this morning? Have you made Jesus Christ the Lord and Master of your life? It's so simple to do that. You come in simple trusting faith, repenting of everything that's sin in your life, confessing the name of Christ, and being buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of past sins. And that makes Jesus the Lord and Master of your life. If you've never done that, I'd beg you to do it before you leave this building this morning, and God will then be your Heavenly Father. Maybe you've done that. You haven't lived your life in the will of God. You haven't lived as God would have you to live. You need to come back home. Can we do something to help you make Jesus the Lord and Master of your life? If there are changes that need to be made, and we can help you make those changes, we invite you to come and let us do that as together we stand and while we sing.